Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, as tensions continue to rise over the presence of federal immigration and customs enforcement agents in communities across the country, New York Governor Kathy Hochul took her strongest stance yet. We'll get a report from the New York Public News Network. In Pennsylvania, Governor Shapiro is expected to address housing costs in his budget speech tomorrow, as rents are soaring, homelessness is rising, and home ownership is out of reach for many families in the Keystone State. We'll get a preview from Spotlight PA. Students across the country and across the counties of New York are earning college credit without leaving their high schools. We'll talk with SUNY Sullivan about a program connecting local classrooms to college degrees, plus local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington and Chamber Chats after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Parts of the federal government are still shut down this morning. Congress did not fund all agencies by last week's deadline. On Friday, the Senate passed a huge bill to reopen them, but it only funded the Department of Homeland Security for 2 weeks. House Speaker Mike Johnson says his chamber now needs to meet and pass this bill in order to end the shutdown.
Our intention is by Tuesday to fund all agencies of the federal government except for that one, and then we'll have 2 weeks of good faith negotiations to figure it out.
He spoke to NBC's Meet the Press. Democrats want to rein in federal immigration agents' tactics, and they want them to take off their masks. A 5-year-old boy and his father, who were arrested in Minnesota by federal agents and detained in Texas, have gone home. They were released by the order of a federal judge. Lawyers say federal agents used the preschooler as bait to get other people out of his home. Meanwhile, the boy's school district is closed today. Columbia Heights Public Schools near Minneapolis says that is because of a credible threat. The mayor of Portland, Oregon, says federal immigration agents near an ICE facility tear-gassed protesters on Saturday. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports the mayor is demanding that the agents leave Portland.
Thousands turned out for a union-backed rally against increased immigration enforcement. Federal officers responding to some protesters who had gathered onto the driveway of the ICE facility blocking a security gate deployed tear gas. That tear gas drifted through the air into a much larger crowd of demonstrators made up of families, including children and elderly people. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson condemned federal officers' actions, saying they had deployed heavy waves of chemical munitions on peaceful protesters who did not pose a threat. The incident comes as a federal judge is set to take up a lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Oregon, arguing federal law enforcement has used excessive force on peaceful protesters. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Walt Disney Company reported better-than-expected quarterly results. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 150 points in early trading.
Disney's movie studio did a strong box office business thanks to hits like Zootopia 2 and the latest Avatar movie. The company's theme parks and cruise ship division reported record revenue, although Disney warned international visits to its theme parks in California and Florida could suffer in the current quarter. Economists are praising President Trump's latest pick to head the agency that tracks inflation and unemployment. Brett Matsumoto is described as a technocratic data nerd. Trump fired the agency's previous leader last August after a disappointing jobs report. An earlier nominee withdrew after criticism that he was overly partisan and lacked experience. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 180 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. It's dangerously cold in some parts of the East Coast this morning, the National Weather Service says. This comes after a significant winter storm pounded the Carolinas and parts of Georgia and Virginia this weekend. Some parts of North Carolina got 18 inches of snow. Hollywood had a fairly lackluster weekend, but NPR's Bob Mondello reports there have been some surprises.
The Disney thriller Send Help was expected to top the chart with ticket sales of about $20 million, but what's coming in second is startling. Iron Lung, a low-budget video game adaptation from a dedicated YouTuber.
You did test this thing, right?
This is the test.
It was originally slated for 60 screens, but after director Mark Fishbach urged his online followers to request it at their local theaters, Iron Lung ended up on 3,000 screens. It will take in more than $17 million in 3 days, about 5 times what it cost to make. Coming in third is Melania, a documentary about First Lady Melania Trump.
I feel energized.
to serve the American people.
It will earn a better-than-expected $7 million for the weekend. Not bad for a documentary, but not great since Amazon spent more than $35 million to advertise it. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
Two musicians set records last night at the Grammys. Bad Bunny's Debbie Tirar Mas Fotos, a love letter to his Puerto Rican home, is the first Spanish-language album to win Album of the Year. Rapper Kendrick Lamar won 5 Grammys. He was the most awarded artist last night, the second year in a row. He is also the most awarded rapper in Grammys history. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Governor Kathy Hochul still hasn't backed the sweeping New York for All Act, but she's now moving to block one of its most controversial practices. In a surprise move Friday, Governor Hochul proposed legislation that would ban New York cities and counties from entering into certain contracts with federal immigration authorities. It's her strongest public stance so far on ICE. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Samantha Simmons reports.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul wants ICE out of New York. Speaking in New York City Friday, the Democrats said she is proposing a new law that would ban agreements between local police departments and federal immigration agents.
Cutting off access to our jails, to ICE agents, will make it harder for them to operate these large-scale operations, which they're building up to try and do right now in the state of New York. We've seen the warning signs. It's happening. That's what they did in Minneapolis. Get large-scale detention centers. Use the local jails for these purposes. And that's what we want to head off.
In 2018, Rensselaer became the first county in New York to enter a so-called 287G agreement to allow deputies to enforce federal immigration laws within the county jail. Rensselaer County officials say they will continue the county's participation in the 287G program. County Executive Steve McLaughlin, a Republican, said of Hochul in a statement, quote, "By her actions, she is a supporter of open borders at any cost," unquote. County Sheriff Kyle Bergault says his department's agreement with ICE only allows people who have been arrested and booked to be screened by agents. Bergault, a Republican, says the governor's statements Friday are generalized and don't take into consideration Rensselaer County's jail-focused approach. He added Rensselaer County Sheriff's Department, quote, "isn't ripping people out of cars or off of the streets," unquote. State Senator Jake Ashby, a Republican, whose district encompasses Rensselaer County, says what we've seen across the country and even locally is not always positive or supportive.
I support ICE in New York searching out criminals, right? So people that are here who are undocumented, who have an element of criminality surrounding them, who have committed crimes. There's a difference between the administrative warrants that are going on and the criminal warrants that are going on, and where they're being detained, right? We need to reexamine that. And I think we can do that in a thoughtful manner in New York State. But yes, I do support ICE protecting the public from criminal elements. That being said, you know, what we're seeing in Minneapolis and frankly what we've seen sometimes here in our own community is not that. And we need to make a positive change for that. I don't think that's going to occur by grandstanding and screaming at each other. I think it's going to come through thoughtful policy reflection and productive discussions.
Meantime, Hochul says she wants local police to continue to help federal agents track down, quote, violent criminals, unquote.
We'll always cooperate with federal government to bring violent criminals to justice. Full stop. That's not a change in policy. However, it does not mean that New York State will stand for flagrant abuse of power under the guise of public safety.
The proposed legislation would require a judicial order to arrest people accused of crimes facing threats from ICE and ban the use of local departments' technologies to assist ICE investigations. After proposing legislation in her State of the State earlier this month, designating houses of worship, schools, and hospitals as sensitive locations where ICE cannot enter without a judicial warrant, Hochul is also planning to include private homes on the list. As Hochul and state leaders consider measures that could lead to changes in New York law, some leaders are taking matters into their own hands. Rockland County legislator Beth J. Davidson, who is also running to replace Republican Mike Lawler in New York's 17th Congressional District, says she is planning to put forward the Safety and Dignity for All Act, which would block county officials from collaborating with ICE.
So under this law, county employees will absolutely still be required to comply with judicial warrants and follow the law. It's, you know, not about letting dangerous or violent criminals off scot-free, but about protecting everyone else from ICE, which has become a completely rogue and out-of-control agency.
The bill is based on a 2018 Westchester County law called the Immigration Protection Act, which bans county employees from using its resources to assist federal investigations based on race, gender, religion, or ethnicity, except in criminal matters or when ICE has a judicial warrant. Representative Lawler, whose district includes Rockland, told the New York Post, quote, Beth Davidson is willing to sacrifice the safety of Rockland County residents for the support of far-left radical Democrats, unquote. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Samantha Simmons.
Coming up next, rents are rising, homelessness is growing, and housing affordability is front and center in Pennsylvania politics. Ahead of Governor Josh Shapiro's long-awaited housing plan, Spotlight PA reporter Charlotte Keith joins us to explain what's driving the crisis and what solutions could actually make a difference. That's next on Radio Chatskill.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The shooting death of Alex Preti in Minneapolis by federal authorities has sparked national outrage and a debate about the future of immigration enforcement, not to mention American democracy. But how are residents of the Twin Cities feeling, and what message do they have for the rest of the country? Join me and Minnesota Public Radio's Catherine Richard for a special town hall from Minnesota from NPR News and The Mill.
Coming up tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. For a lot of Pennsylvanians, owning a home feels more out of reach than ever. As Governor Josh Shapiro gets ready to roll out a long-awaited statewide housing plan in his budget speech tomorrow, there's growing interest and plenty of questions about whether it can really move the needle. I spoke with Charlotte Keith, a reporter with Spotlight PA, who's been closely reporting on the housing shortage, the policy debates in Harrisburg, and what this plan could mean for people across the state.
So in September 2024, the governor issued this executive order basically saying that the state would put together a plan to tackle the housing crisis in Pennsylvania and make recommendations on the best way to do that, as well as looking at existing state programs and how well they're working. And so state officials have been working on this for months. They've spoken to thousands of people, and they've gotten, you know, a ton of written feedback. They've held listening sessions across the state. And so now the governor is preparing to release that plan at some point soon, and we'll kind of see, you know, what's in it.
And, you know, as we're waiting to see what's in it, what are some of the aspects that would make a tangible difference, and what might face some significant political hurdles?
So, I mean, one issue that state officials heard about over and over as they were, you know, asking advocates, developers, local officials about this was that local zoning laws often make it hard to add the housing that Pennsylvania needs, because a lot of land is zoned for single family homes. And one way to add more housing more efficiently and in a way that's more affordable would be to change those zoning laws so that Pennsylvania could add apartment buildings on, you know, areas currently zoned for commercial use or near public transit, or, you know, one thing that a lot of states have done is to legalize what's called accessory dwelling units. So those are like granny flats, backyard cottages, basement apartments. But one, you know, big hurdle of that is that any changes to the state law that governs local zoning is probably going to face pretty stiff opposition from the groups that represent Pennsylvania municipalities. That's certainly been the case in other states that have done this. And those groups, you know, they argue that local governments know their communities best and therefore are in the best position to make decisions about land use. And they say that this focus on zoning, it kind of becomes a scapegoat when there are other issues that contribute to the housing shortage, like the rising cost of construction and supply chain disruptions. And so it's certainly going to be contentious if the state is, you know, trying to make changes in that area.
Underlying Pennsylvania's housing crunch, as you write, is the law of supply and demand. How does Pennsylvania compare to other states in terms of building new housing and addressing affordability?
Yeah, so Pennsylvania has really lagged when it comes to building new housing. There was a report from the Pew Charitable Trust, which found that the state ranked 44th out of the 50 states on the rate of housing being built. And state officials estimate that to keep up with the demand, Pennsylvania would need to add 450,000 units by 2035. That would be like a 70% increase. So that would be a, you know, pretty significant addition. And it goes back to, you know, that basic supply and demand thing, because Pennsylvania is not building enough housing to keep up with the demand, and that drives costs up. It's not a problem that is spread evenly across the whole state, because obviously there are certain areas that are really growing and where people want to live. And so it's in those places, you know, like the Philadelphia suburbs, the Northeast, and some small cities that are experiencing the steepest rising costs.
And are you seeing any solutions or models from other states that Pennsylvania might look to adopt to ease the crunch?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that in recent years, other states have really increasingly taken on because, you know, the shortage of housing is a national problem. And so there is a lot that Pennsylvania can look at, different options, different approaches, and some of the pitfalls that other states have dealt with. You know, in terms of the different approaches and some of the solutions. And also, I think just the lesson that, you know, it's not as if you pass one bill one year and that fixes everything. A lot of states, you know, it's taken them years to reach consensus on what to do, or they pass bills one year and then they come back and they strengthen them the next year. So I think it seems clear that, you know, if Pennsylvania does act on this year, it's going to be a pretty sustained effort. It's not something that there's really like a quick fix for.
And you're also reporting that Pennsylvania doesn't just need to build more housing. They need to help people stay in their current homes. Talk a little bit more about what that looks like and how also evictions and foreclosures and similar problems play into this.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that comes up a lot because advocates always make the point that, you know, the most affordable home in many cases is the one that someone already has. And Pennsylvania has a really old housing stock, some of the oldest in the country. And so one problem is that over time, a lot of homeowners just can't keep up with the cost of repairs. But if they had to, if they lost that house and they had to find something else, or they had to get help from a program to get them somewhere else, that might be more expensive than just helping them make the cost of that repair. And so that's something the state has tried to do in recent years. There was a big new program created in 2022 to help low-income homeowners with the cost of repairs, but re-upping that program has proven difficult to get through the state legislature, and it's not something that has, you know, been successful. But that was definitely something the state heard a lot about in the feedback, and it seems likely that some form of home repair proposal is going to be, you know, part of the proposed solution. And yeah, like you mentioned, another issue is evictions and foreclosures. The groups that provide legal services to low-income residents say they've really seen a dramatic increase in the number of people seeking help with those, and that housing cases are now like the single largest category of issues they deal with. And so there are proposals to do things like seal eviction records in some cases, which could help renters by, you know, if you have an eviction that's filed against you, but it doesn't actually go through, or you have an eviction filed against you, but it was unfair. If those records could be sealed, it could help people, you know, not be prevented from getting new housing in the future because of that. That's something the governor has said he supports, but it would require changing state law as well.
Can the governor make any changes in housing through executive action?
Yeah, so I think that there could be changes that could be done through executive action, but certainly a lot of the bigger things and things that would require new investments would take changing state law. And, you know, it's complicated. On the one hand, housing has proven to be an issue that can really cut through the political divides in Harrisburg, where, you know, for something to become law, it has to win support from Democrats who control the state house, as well as from Republicans who control the state Senate. And there have been, you know, areas, things on housing that have gained bipartisan support in recent years, increases for a state program that helps build affordable housing, and a major expansion of this property tax rent rebate program that helps older and disabled residents with the cost of housing. So it definitely is an area where, you know, that there is opportunity for consensus. I think one challenge that people are concerned about is, you know, always state spending and new investment can be difficult when the state is facing a structural budget deficit. There are some federal cuts that are going to be hitting this year, and it's definitely a priority for Republican lawmakers to bring state spending down. But some of the things that, you know, are being talked about to do with housing, some of them would be, you know, little to no cost to the state, but certainly some of them would probably require state investments.
Similar efforts in Harrisburg haven't gained a lot of traction. Do you think that the time is right now for folks to push Pennsylvania forward here?
I mean, it's difficult to make predictions about what will happen in the state legislature. I will say a lot of the people that I spoke to for this story are optimistic that this year, you know, with the momentum from this plan and maybe building some consensus around that, it could be, you know, a good year to get things done. Senate Republicans have also said that housing is a top priority for them this year. So, you know, that certainly makes people feel optimistic. But on the other hand, you know, any time that there are budget negotiations, there are a lot of issues competing, and what happens in, you know, the final deal is always sort of complicated. And so it's definitely, you know, at this point, difficult to predict one way or the other.
That's Charlotte Keith of Spotlight PA. You can read her reporting at spotlightpa.org. Charlotte, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Governor Shapiro, in his budget address tomorrow, is expected to mention housing costs as well as increased energy demand and some other unfinished business from prior years, from education and transportation funding to recreational cannabis legalization to regulating slot-like skill games. We'll bring all of that speech to you tomorrow starting at 11 here on Radio Catskill. Now we'll take a break, and when we come back, it's local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
NPR Music is looking for the next great undiscovered musician to play the tiny desk. If you're an unsigned artist, record a video of yourself playing one original song behind a desk and submit it to the 11th annual Tiny Desk Contest by February 9th. And if you win, you'll play your very own Tiny Desk concert. Think you've got what it takes? Learn more at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill, and it's Monday. Working 9 to 5. That means we get to hear from James B. Huntington with some local economic perspective. James B., hello.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, let's jump in and talk about interest rates. What happened with interest rates last week?
Yes, well, they held steady this time after 3 consecutive reductions the previous times at the end of the year. They stayed the same, still 3.5 to 3.75%. it's not surprising, not the least bit surprising, is 99% of the people who forecasted this thought they were going to stay the same. Powell is talking about the economy surprising us with its strength, not for the first time. Inflation is down a little, enough to make it not necessary to raise rates. So it looked like it would be worse to lower them and keep them the same, and they kept them the same, so that is where we are. There's all bets are off for the next time, but of course, as always, they will have more data by then, and they'll be able to make a decision based on then.
Yep, unchanged for now. Let's talk about the latest statistics we have about the economy. This is for third quarter last year. Some of these things delayed because of the shutdown. What is that telling us about the U.S. economy's performance?
It had a big quarter. It went up at a rate of 4.4% annualized for July through September. It was better than what economists thought, which was 25% less than that. Fastest growth rate in 2 years. Overall, the acceleration in real GDP reflected upturns in investment, exports, and government spending, as well as a big rise in consumer spending. It was a strong holiday season, stronger than a lot of people thought, and people are still out there spending money. So that's helped the economy, which looks quite strong. And this was an input into the Fed's decision because it was 6 days earlier that this report came out. So that's what we have, and that's what we got.
And we've got some other data, localized data for unemployment figures. This is from November. What is that showing us about unemployment rates in our region?
Yes, unemployment rates here were 3.7% in Sullivan County, up 0.1% from September, which is the previous month because there was no October data for anything from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Orange County, 3.8%, down 0.4%. Ulster County, 3.6%, down 0.2%. Wayne County, 3.7%, also down 0.2%. And Pike County, 4.3%, down 0.4%. So that was the highest one for Pike County, and it matched the national unadjusted unemployment number. These numbers are also unadjusted at 4.3%, which stayed the same. So our area as a whole got considerably better when that was not true for the country as a whole. So we have, it's a big general improvement. It's something that was already strong. We're already, so we are really in some elite territory as far as the number of jobs and the lack of unemployment. We're doing exceedingly well. So once again, kudos to everyone in local government who has helped bring this about.
It's good to hear. With all the news that's going on, something that seems to have gotten a little bit lost, President Trump a couple of weeks ago called for a 10% credit card rate cap. That's a campaign promise he's revived to cap interest rates. That's thrown banks and lenders into a bit of a tizzy because they get a lot of profit from those bank fees. But why are people saying that this 10% cap on credit card interest rates won't work?
Well, nobody saluted that flag. The credit card industry did not follow through and do that. There's no evidence of any company bringing rates down from the 20 or 30%, which are common, to 10%. So the word is that from an advisor and expert on these things, if you're waiting for it to go from 20 to 10% on your statement, don't hold your breath. It's controversial anyway because consumer experts say that Trump does not have the power to mandate any credit rate cap. So It's not happening. It's been ignored, and it really wouldn't be a good thing anyway. The response consistently when companies and such were polled if they had to do something like this was that they would eliminate credit for people instead of just lowering it for a lot less, that they would toughen up their standards for who can borrow money and who can have cards with them. So, again, someone says something where they're looking for Santa Claus, and it turns out there is no such thing. And it seems dead, and dead it should be.
Yeah, there's no obvious pathway for the administration to unilaterally impose an interest cap. Congress doesn't seem to want to heed that request. And as you said, bank leaders, industry lobbyists are just dancing around it, hoping it goes away. And it seems like it's sort of fading out.
One thing, yes, I think it's gone away.
One thing that's not fading out is this term affordability. You get it thrown around a lot from a lot of different people, in a lot of different ways, a lot of different meanings. The New York Times and CNN University conducted a poll about that word, affordability. What do Americans really mean by affordability then?
It was different. I have the results from this poll, and different people said different things, and they were not quite what I would have expected for one thing. You think about affordability, it sounded to me like it's what you think of when you go to the grocery store or gas station. But really, by a 2-to-1 margin, voters said that it meant a middle-class life was out of reach. It was for the big things like housing and health insurance and the overall cost of raising children and the amount of money you need for retirement. That came up as the most common thing. That's what 51% named at least one of those as what they had concerns about affording. Then there were 23% who named the things I would have thought, the monthly bills or other expenses, groceries, utilities, gas, cars. And then you have 10% naming other things like vacations, taxes, and luxuries and things they choose to buy, the voluntary, the discretionary spending and such things. And 16% said they really didn't worry about any of it. So now that we have more of a definition, it seems to mean a wide range of things. So everybody saying that things will be affordable means that a lot of different categories will have to go down in price, which certainly seems less likely than a few specific things. Mm. So different attitudes and different feelings.
Well, it's tax season. What tax season scams are kind of surging this year? There's always some scam. What's the latest thing we should be on the lookout for?
Yes, well, we have some problems, some things going on usually around this time when people get conscious of taxes and started doing things that the scammers come out. So what we have are IRS impersonation scams. They're getting to be higher quality. That's a warning for you. Usually they have misspelled words and such things, and they're looking a lot better physically. They're fake refund or account alert messages. They'll get things like, IRS notice your refund is on hold due to a filing discrepancy under updated 2026 rules. They'll usually stick something in there about changes so the taxpayer doesn't think they know as much as they actually do. Verify your identity now to avoid displays. I mean, a lot of these are the same red flags that they've always had, that scams in general have. It's like they direct you to non-government websites, and they ask for things like Social Security numbers, bank details, or login credentials, things that they probably would not ask. They're also urgent. They also always say, you've got to fix this right now. And the IRS doesn't work that way. If they have something really hot, really urgent, something that needs a resolution, that's when they give you 2 weeks or something. The IRS never insists that you do things right then. So what you do is you just stop engaging. That's the main thing. Don't do anything immediately. slow down. I mean, advice number one for staying safe during tax season is slow down before responding to messages. You can also contact the IRS directly, and they can look these things up and see if something like this was really sent to you and confirm it. And you could ask them about the urgency when they usually, when they would never do such a thing. Verify filing changes, yes, through official IRS channels. If you got something saying there's been some big change to you made, again, contact the IRS. Protect tax accounts with strong credentials, the two-factor authentication and all that. Watch for pressure tactics and refund promises. Again, the IRS is a collection agency. That's all they are. They're not looking to immediately take money off you. They have their due process. They're very big on due process. And they'll always give you time to research these things and figure out how you're going to respond on your own. And, of course, antivirus software and reducing your digital footprint. Be careful about what personal data you have out there in some form. So, again, and once again, just be skeptical. Just wonder. I mean, people with any kind of normal tax filing profiles are not going to get smashed with some message like this.
Well, one of the things I'm kind of skeptical of is that groundhog predicting the weather, but thousands of other people are maybe not. They gathered for the 140th celebration of Groundhog Day at Gobbler's Knob in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, to see the famous Punxsutawney Phil emerge from his tree stump to predict what will happen in terms of weather in the winter. What did Phil have to say? Oh, please make it a good news story, James B.
Well, they had a good time. It was about 2 degrees, they were saying. People were all gathered up outside. One said that tens of thousands of people. It's amazing. It looked like I could see thousands in a group on the screen. They're watching this area for speakers and making presentations of things going on. They played a lot of music, most really rock and roll, but some classical recordings and some country. And then they introduced their inner circle, the dandies in their top hats, and pulled out the groundhog, Punxsutawney Phil, put him up on the stand, and he got closer to one of the two scrolls with proclamations, and they pulled it out and read it, and bad news. Mm. 6 more weeks of winter.
No, well,
the good news is 6 weeks from today is March 16th, and I think some of us would be very happy the way the climate goes to be done with winter by March 16th.
Absolutely.
So let's hope it doesn't get any worse than that.
Well, and also locally, yesterday at the Sullivan County Museum, not sure if you heard about this, but that dog named Gidget was challenging Punxsutawney Phil with her own prognosticating, but also chose the 6 weeks of winter scroll. So all the animals are in cahoots, it seems, 6 more
weeks.
Yes,
well, great animal minds think alike, I'm afraid. Well, we'd rather know now than be hopeful through the rough days of February and early March.
All right, let's talk about what the minds are thinking on Wall Street. What are the numbers this morning, and how did they change?
Okay, this is a 3-week interval because it's been that long since I've been on the air here. We had some big events. It's like we're in some of these things, we're looking at two sides of a mountain, and these prices don't say what the mountain was like for a while there. Gold, $47.11 the ounce, up $116 from 3 weeks ago, but it's gone down about $900 since its peak last week. Silver, $81.90, down $2.38. Seems pretty calm and pretty bad until you realize that it hit $118 The ratio, which was down to 46 to 1 at one point, is now 57.5 to 1 between silver and gold. We don't know where it's going, but it's still very high by historical standards. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 48,892, down 232. That was spent most of the last 3 weeks in the 49s. Hasn't really done a lot. There have been a lot of down days, so it's better than the last one I read when it was down 700 and some. NASDAQ, 23,462, down 209, a higher percentage. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $61.99 the barrel, up $3.12. Disappointing when all these things are going down to see oil going up. I'd rather it be the exact opposite. But some prices are getting higher, and there's still gas in New Jersey in the 250s, so it may just take a while. It may not stay in that range. It may just bounce back to where it was. Bitcoin, 77,625. That's down over 13,000. Could Bitcoin be in real trouble? It always goes up and down a lot, but it's a long way below its peak also. British pound, 1.3703, up about 2.5 cents. The dollar keeps sinking, and the same thing happened with the euro, which is 1.1862, up 1.7 cents. Japanese 100 yen coin even got in the act, and is now 65 cents, up 2 cents. So overall, if you were out for the last 3 weeks, you might think this was a lousy but pretty tame time, but it was anything but. So it's still looking very volatile. We may have some big changes both up and down. There's a lot going on, obviously, behind the scenes. So we'll expect different numbers when we see them.
All right. That's our local economist and author, James B. Huntington, with Local Economic Perspective. James B., thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
Coming up, high schoolers are getting college credit early. How it works and who qualifies, that's coming up next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Years ago, Bobby Parmar was on a long hike when he started to feel he was going the wrong way.
All of a sudden, the terrain started to look different than what we were expecting. But it was easier to keep moving than it was to admit that I was wrong.
When to listen to the voice of doubt in your head. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. SUNY Sullivan is giving students a chance to earn college credit before they even graduate high school. The college is hosting a college and high school information night tomorrow night for students in grades 8 through 12 and also for their parents. The program partners with local school districts to offer college-level courses in familiar classrooms, helping students save time, money, and build confidence early on. Joining us now is Jason Kaplan, an associate professor at SUNY Sullivan and the coordinator of the College in High School program, and Eleanor Davis from SUNY Sullivan. Welcome to you both. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
Jason, for listeners who may not know about this, talk a little bit more about this SUNY Sullivan College and High School program. How does it work?
Sure. So the college and high school program allows students to take college courses while they're in high school. So they're getting basically a dual credit, high school credit, college credit at the same time. And it basically, it's a situation where they can sort of get an early start on their college career, on the path to, you know, whatever their professional goal is. And it's an opportunity to take the courses in an environment that they're familiar with, their high school classrooms, and also, you know, typically for a lot less money that it would cost them if they were to take the classes as a college student after high school.
It's kind of a head start on college. And why is that so important for this age range, grades 8 through 12, getting this confidence right now and getting them to be able to see themselves as college bound earlier?
Well, that's really exactly it. So it builds confidence. It lets them kind of get a taste in some cases, it gives them like a taste of college class. And for others, you know, it's not only a confidence builder, but it gives them an opportunity to start ahead of time and to see that they can do this and they are, you know, they're able to, and maybe that changes their sort of, you know, direction or their focus on what they want to do after school as well.
Eleanor, talk a little bit about the timing of this. Why is it important to do this now when it's, you know, it's February and winter, but you kids got to start thinking about college sooner rather than later.
Well, they do. And the way that the high schools matriculate them is through their advisor. So it's important to get the information to parents as well as the students early on so they can start planning what they're going to take next year. Students, I think, get an idea of where they're going to go and what they're going to do at a pretty young age. And, you know, we've had experiences with students who really didn't see themselves as college at all until they took some of our classes in high school. One student that comes to mind graduated as a valedictorian, won the Chancellor's Award, the highest award that SUNY offers, did the Promise Scholarship, had no debt. And he said the thing that, you know, first-generation American, thing that got him, you know, inspired to do this were the college and high school classes. It built his confidence, and suddenly he saw himself as college material, and he walked into a very well-paying job nursing from SUNY Sullivan. So we have a lot of stories like this. And, you know, the other thing that we do that I think people don't realize is we do a lot of professional development with teachers in the high schools. And that's important so that these classes are really quality classes and we have that professional relationship with faculty.
Yeah, I want to ask about that that relationship and that development. And SUNY faculty play a big role in developing that with the high school teachers. How do you guys do that for the help of getting them to deliver these courses to the students?
Absolutely. So it's really important to us that we're not just offering, we're not just putting our sort of logo on the syllabus for the class or just kind of putting our stamp on it. We're making sure that the academic rigor in these classrooms, you know, aligns with what they would have if they were to take the classes on our campus. We're making sure that the instructors are, you know, they're meeting the same qualifications that they would meet if they taught on our campus. We're providing training. We provide, you know, professional development and training for them. We do a number of classroom observations where our faculty go in to the classrooms and observe and give feedback and start conversations with the teachers just to make sure that these are truly college classes that are being offered in the high school.
They're rigorous. There's some rigor to them. There's some meat on the bone, so to speak. And some of the most popular ones are English composition, speech, pre-calculus. Those align with SUNY's general admission requirements. Why is that alignment so important for students then later on?
So for any student going into especially any SUNY college, but even the students that choose not to come to our college or if they do come to our college and then transfer, we just want to make sure that they have as much credit that will transfer as possible, things that will align with you know, SUNY's requirement and a lot of other schools' requirements. So they're not, you know, they're not kind of wasting their time just taking a class that's not going to count, you know, if they go forward towards like their bachelor's degree, for example.
Let's talk about this college information night tomorrow. Let's get the details. Who wants to give us the details here?
Sure. So if you go to our homepage of our website, there's an article about the college and high school night, and you can click through to register. Our admissions staff will be there. There'll be information for parents. And, you know, I think people don't realize the scope of this program. We have over 700 students in Sullivan County taking our college level classes, 150 courses being offered. Two of the high schools actually grant AA degrees because they have so many classes that we offer that students can complete an AA degree while they finish high school. So it's a very comprehensive program. And in terms of finding out about pathways for courses you take and how they might align with degrees that SUNY Sullivan offers, the College Information Night is a great chance to talk to people who really have expertise in this area.
Jason, if there was a student or parent that's on the fence about this, why would you say it's worth an hour of their time?
We like people who are on the fence because this is an opportunity for us to sort of educate them, tell them the pros and cons, and to really give them the information to make an informed decision about whether their child or their family member should be taking these classes. So it's an opportunity for those already in the program to kind of find out information about maybe taking further classes, getting their degree, et cetera, transferability. And those who are not yet in the program taking college and high school classes, an opportunity for them to learn about maybe, give them some guidance on what classes to take, maybe what programs they're interested, what classes maybe they shouldn't take, and so on.
Jason Kaplan and Eleanor Davis from SUNY Sullivan. College in High School Information Night is tomorrow. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Take a break, and when we come back, we'll meet Joel DeYoung from the Chamber of the Northern Poconos, part of our Chamber Chat series. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
With dangerously cold temperatures in the forecast, warming centers are open across our region to provide a safe, heated place for anyone who needs it. Locations are available at Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange counties, as well as Pike County in Pennsylvania. If you or someone you know needs a warm place to go, you can find a full list of locations and hours at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The shooting death of Alex Preddy in Minneapolis by federal authorities has sparked national outrage and a debate about the future of immigration enforcement, not to mention American democracy. But how are residents of the Twin Cities feeling, and what message do they have for the rest of the country? Join me and Minnesota Public Radio's Catherine Richard for a special town hall from Minnesota from NPR News and The Mill.
Coming up tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, we've had our continuing series, Chamber Chats. It's a partnership with the Chamber of the Northern Poconos. And joining us today is Joel DeYoung, the Membership and Marketing Director at the Chamber of the Northern Poconos, to tell us more about what local businesses and how they support local businesses across the area, how they help them connect and thrive, and more about how folks can get involved in supporting the local economy. Joel, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a quick overview. What's the Chamber of the Northern Poconos? And when you say Northern Poconos, what communities are we talking about?
Yeah, so the Chamber of the Northern Poconos represents Wayne and Pike counties. There's a little bit of a backstory there. So the Wayne County Chamber and the Lake Region Chamber, which used to represent Pike County, merged, and that created the Northern Poconos Chamber of Commerce now.
Right. And so we're here in the Catskills, and when you cross the river, you're kind of in the, quote, Northern Poconos. that's the identity you guys have there. You've been relatively new to the role, but very visible in the community. What drew you to this position?
Actually, a third-generation chamber employee now. So my grandmother was the executive director of the Wayne County Chamber. My mother was the executive director of the Lake Region Chamber, and now I'm the marketing and membership director of the Northern Poconos Chamber.
Oh, wow. It stays in the family. That's kind of cool.
Yes, it's a family affair. That's right. Yeah. So I've been doing chamber events since I was a little kid.
So what are your priorities right now? What are the top priorities for you right now as membership and marketing director for the Chamber of the Northern Poconos?
Yeah. Membership and marketing. obviously, building membership to the chamber makes the chamber more powerful. So as you add membership and community to this machine, as you will, the better it runs. The community thrives on networking, and so does the chamber. As long as everybody's putting in to the chamber, they're going to get out tenfold.
And you've been meeting with business owners across the area. What are they telling you, and what are some of the challenges that might be coming up most often?
Yeah, times are tough. Obviously, to leave politics out of it, it's been tough. Our area is a little bit interesting, too, because obviously it was very seasonal. So, and the lake region itself is also very touristic. Mm-hmm. So we're in an interesting spot. Like, for instance, a lot of chambers do heavily bank on their membership and stuff like that. But our chamber is a little bit more event-driven due to the, you know, the geography of our area, unfortunately. Not unfortunately, but fortunately.
It's the reality, yeah.
It is. That's our area, and, you know, we got to love our lake and hopefully support it any way we can.
Are there some upcoming events or initiatives you want people to know about that are folks can get involved with?
Yeah, absolutely. So every year we do our Wally Lake Fest in August. That's a weekend music festival. We put music on the lake and in our local restaurants around the lake. We try to do some other stuff throughout the area as well. We host the fireworks over Lake Wallenpaupack on July 4th. And this year we're also doing a special event called Wally 100. For those that don't know, Lake Wallenpaupack is turning 100 this year. And to coincide with America 250 this year, it's going to be an amazing year.
There's a lot going on. Is there something you're particularly excited about as you look forward to the warmer weather?
Yeah, no snow.
Warmer weather.
Yeah, exactly. Wally Lake Fest is always a blast. I'm a big music nut, so seeing music, especially floating on the lake, seeing people out there on their boats rocking out is very rewarding.
You mentioned this is a family affair. You've been working with the chamber for a long time. What excites you most about the future of the Northern Poconos business community?
Well, there's a lot of entrepreneurs that are coming out of the woodwork. So a lot of people are making their own businesses, doing a lot more specialized stuff, which is really cool. I'm a tech enthusiast, and I see a lot of stuff with AI coming out and things of that nature. So it's really cool to see the advancement in the futuristic part of the future.
The future is now. Where can folks get more information and connect and also, you know, maybe get involved? What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, so the best way is we're on Facebook and TikTok, Facebook and Instagram, but also we have a website. That's northernpoconoschamber.org. My email is members@northernpoconos.org. If anybody has any questions, they can shoot me an email. But again, on Facebook, Northern Poconos Chamber, Instagram, all that.
That's Joel DeYoung, the membership and marketing director for the Chamber of the Northern Poconos. He's making mom and the family proud. Thank you so much, Joel. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Tim, for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. We'll wrap the show up here in a minute. But before we go, I wanted to let you know about a special program that's coming up tonight. That is coming up with a special from MPR. That is Minnesota Public Radio. It's a town hall, a special about ice in Minnesota. They're exploring the reality on the ground in Minnesota during the unprecedented ice enforcement operation and how it is impacting folks. It's something you don't want to miss. It is tonight at 6, preempting the local edition and the daily. It's from MPR News and the Middle with Jeremy Hobson. It's packed with first-person testimony of what they're experiencing there on the ground. Also covers the larger political context. It's tonight at 6 here on Radio Catskill. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, physician and healthcare policymaker Zeke Emanuel.
A lot of the wellness gurus out there, they make things way too complicated.
So how does Emanuel see wellness?
It should be something that you actually enjoy.
The wellness industry is gigantic and mostly wrong. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, a respite from the deep freeze for the next few days. Sunny, not as cold, a little breezy today, though, a high 26. Tonight, a low of 3. We might see snow and a heavy squall impacting some travel later in the week, but it'll get windy and very cold again on the weekend. Let's put that aside for now. Tomorrow, a high of 28, mostly cloudy, 26 for Wednesday, and then we might see some cold and snow on Friday with a high of 22. On Point is coming up next from WBUR Boston. This is Radio Chatskill. Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.